The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Religion News Service, and News and Observer. Our first article was published by the Los Angeles Times on June the 4th and written by Laura King, entitled Notre Dame Spire, Which Fell in Flames, Set to Rise Again. When the world's most recognizable cathedral, Notre Dame de Paris, burned on April 15, 2019, the toppling of its spire was the catastrophe's defining moment, a loop endlessly replayed that seemed improbably to last forever. It was so hard to believe what we were seeing, said Agnès Poiret, a journalist and author who was among the throngs watching the conflagration from the left bank of the Seine. She remembers the desolate cry that went up from the crowd at that moment. Now the spire is slowly rising again. The French government had hoped to reopen Notre Dame to worshippers and visitors in time for the Summer Olympics in 2024, when Paris will be a focus of worldwide attention and tourists will crowd the city. That target date is now December of that year. But settling in place the spire's cross-shaped base, a complex operation that took place after the enormous wooden trestle was constructed and then deconstructed at a sprawling work site 200 miles to the northeast, marked an important symbolic milestone in Notre Dame's rebirth. The 80-ton support, known as the tabouret, or stool, was built in the town of Braye by carpenters employing centuries-old woodworking craftsmanship, as well as modern-day methods such as 3D modeling and laser measurement. In recent weeks, element by giant element, it was hoisted by cranes onto the cathedral's gusty rooftop. A bravura ballet performed 180 feet in the air. A great joy, Jean-Louis Georgelin, the French army general in charge of the restoration, called the base's reassembly. A crucial prelude to the delicate pinnacle eventually attaining its full height of nearly 300 feet above the ground. From this summer, we will see the spire gradually rising into the sky of Paris, the general said in a statement marking the fire's fourth anniversary. Poiret rose early the morning after the fire. In the pink glow of dawn, she gazed at the familiar silhouette of Notre Dame's twin bell towers and the gaping void left by the missing spire. She was injured, Poiret said of the cathedral, but still standing, still there. As Notre Dame burned, the spire was both a casualty of the flames and a weapon of destruction that threatened the entire edifice. Its collapse sent tons of fiery oak timbers laced with molten lead crashing to the cathedral floor, imperiling fragile walls and vaults. Experts later said that had the 400 firefighters been unable to halt the spreading flame, the cathedral would have burned beyond repair within half an hour. An investigation into the origin of the fire, which began directly under the roof, was inconclusive. Even before the inferno, the spire was in disrepair, its degraded state a major impetus behind a restoration project launched 3 years earlier. It was already surrounded by scaffolding when the fire broke out, with the statues adorning it removed for safekeeping just 4 days earlier. The cathedral has been spireless before, for nearly 60 years, when the badly deteriorating original, constructed in the 1200s, was taken down in the late 18th century to stop it from falling down on its own. Now a brief update from the News and Observer. Famous monastery celebrates 1,000th year. The mystical Mont Saint-Michel Monastery, a World Heritage Site on an outcropping off the shore of France's Normandy region, celebrated its 100th birthday on June 5. The Benedictine Abbey has received a makeover featuring a new bridge with eco-friendly waterproofing technology that replaced the old causeway. French President Emmanuel Macron attended the celebration before traveling on to D-Day events. Now an article from the New York Times that was published on June 4 and entitled "Hundreds of Perpetrators and Thousands of Victims," written by Ruth Graham. The nearly 900-page report landed like a grenade when Josh Shapiro, then the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, delivered it on a stage in Harrisburg 5 years ago. It detailed widespread sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church throughout Pennsylvania and a sophisticated cover-up by senior church officials. Victims of abuse and their families, sometimes visibly weeping, joined Mr. Shapiro on the stage. More than 300 priests were found to have abused children, at least 1,000 of them over the course of 7 decades. The report reverberated at the highest levels of the church, with the Vatican expressing shame and sorrow over the findings. And it reached the pews, too. A Gallup poll the next year found that more than one-third of Catholics in the United States were considering leaving the faith because of recent news about sexual abuse of young people by priests. In the years since the Pennsylvania report was published, it has inspired some 20 other investigations into the Catholic Church by state attorneys general. Now the result of those investigations are rolling out, refocusing attention on the sprawling abuse scandal, and in some cases, providing fresh details. The Attorney General of Illinois, Kwame Raoul, released a report in May that found more than 450 credibly accused child sex abusers in the Catholic Church in Illinois since 1950. Almost 2,000 children under 18 were victims. These reports have not led to many criminal prosecutions. Many of the accused have died or statutes of limitations have expired. But victims of clerical sexual abuse and their advocates say the reports have had a lasting impact in other ways. In some states, the reports have helped persuade legislators to extend time limits for victims to sue alleged abusers. And many victims say that such public and official acknowledgement of what happened is a welcome step. People talk about this being about sex, or a more academic analysis describes it as being about power, said Terrence McKeown, the president of bishopaccountability.org, an advocacy group. But it's also about information. Investigations have been concluded in 7 states so far, and others are continuing, according to Child U.S. Advocacy, a group that supports stronger child abuse legislation. The status of some of the investigations is unclear, frustrating activist groups. For example, the Attorney General's office in California invited victims to come forward with their stories in 2018 and later issued subpoenas in several Catholic dioceses. The office has not issued a public statement on the investigation in years and did not respond to a request for comment. The sheer numbers in the state reports published so far are staggering. 163 perpetrators in Missouri, 97 in Florida, 188 in Kansas. There have been long lists of credibly accused priests and others in Catholic ministry, thousands of pages of victims' narratives, and front page headlines about the findings. Attorneys general have been photographed with towering stacks of documents, hoisting doorstep doorstop publications that are the product of years of research and interviews. The number of accused priests and incidents of abuse peaked between the mid-1960s and mid-1980s and have declined significantly since then, according to a 2011 study commissioned by Catholic bishops and conducted by researchers at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Bishops in the United States adopted new protocols in the early 2000s to crack down on abuse, including a range of zero-tolerance policies. Historically, the church withheld information about priests who were sexually abusive, often moving them from parish to parish without informing people in the pews. The reports have pushed many dioceses to publish or update their own list of credibly accused clergy members. Cardinal Blaise J. Kupich, the Archbishop of Chicago, has disputed some aspects of the Illinois Attorney General's report and questioned the way some of the data was presented. Even so, the Archdiocese cooperated with the investigation, and Cardinal Kupich issued a statement apologizing to all who have been harmed by the failure to prevent and properly respond to child sexual abuse by clerics. In Maryland, Governor Wes Moore signed a law in April abolishing the state statute of limitations for victims of child sexual abuse to sue abusers, effective October 1. He signed the bill less than a week after the state attorneys general released a 436-page report documenting abuse in the Archdiocese of Baltimore. The AG reports are a measure of accountability, even though they don't have a ton of teeth, said Catherine Robb, the executive director of Child USA Advocacy, who helped to write the new Maryland law. They educate the public, and they educate lawmakers to understand. They have this holy crap moment. Survivor groups have urged the Department of Justice to mount a federal investigation of the church. Other groups have tried to sue the church under federal and state racketeering laws, but those suits have fizzled because of high legal hurdles, including the need to prove injury to business or property. According to Stephen Rubino, a lawyer who tried the civil racketeering approach in a suit against the Archdiocese of Camden in the early 1990s. That case was settled. Mr. Rubino later attempted another racketeering suit that was dismissed. Many dioceses face waves of new civil lawsuits and have filed for bankruptcy. For Mr. Shapiro, who is now the governor of Pennsylvania, the report became a signature achievement of his tenure as attorney general. On the campaign trail, he said, people frequently pulled him aside to thank him for the report, sometimes identifying themselves as victims of specific priests who were named in it. From a Pennsylvania perspective, the most significant thing is the way we gave a sense of justice to the victims here, Mr. Shapiro said. Mike McDonald, 54, says he was abused by two priests in the Philadelphia area starting when he was 11. He had no one at a time. He told no one at the time what had happened to him. He began drinking as a preteen and later became addicted to drugs. His story was mentioned in a 2005 report by a grand jury on sexual abuse in the Archdiocese of Pennsylvania. Mr. McDonald said he probably would never have confronted the reality of the abuse, but he had he not seen the men who abused him named in the 2005 report. Knowing myself, I would have continued to anesthetize myself and find other compartments in my soul to bury it, he said. At first, he said, he found it destabilizing to see his experiences reflected in the report. He learned that he was not alone and that leaders in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia knew for years about the behavior of the two priests who abused him. One of them, Francis Trauger, was convicted in 2020 of molesting two altar boys and was sentenced to 18 months to 36 months in prison. Mr. McDonald, who now works for an advocacy group for victims of clerical sexual abuse, was in the courtroom for the sentencing. Seeing that in print and in the public record is really monumental for those who have not had a voice, Mr. McDonald said. That validation is really a kickstart to one's healing journey. Now, an article published by the Religion News Service on May 22, entitled "A New Documentary Takes a Deep Dive into the Ancient and Modern Practice of Sabbath," by Yonat Shimron. In his book, The Sabbath, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote that Jews did not build great cathedrals into space. Their great accomplishment was a cathedral in time, the Shabbat, or a 24-hour period of rest. 6 days a week, we live under the tyranny of things of space. On the Sabbath, we try to become attuned to holiness and time, Heschel wrote. That cathedral in time is part of filmmaker Martin Dobler's latest two-part documentary called Sabbath. The two-hour film began airing on PBS stations June the 1st, but is available to stream on his journeyfilms.com website. As in his previous documentaries, Dobelmeyer has recruited an A-list of theologians, scholars, and clergy to offer their insights, historical, theological, and sociological. The Sabbath first appears in the biblical story of creation when God rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Observance of the Sabbath is also one of the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. But the documentary is not overly concerned with theology. The film consists of travels to various religious communities to illustrate their Sabbath practices. From the headquarters of Chabad, the Hasidic sect in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, to a Seventh-day Adventist church in Loma Linda, California, to the predominantly African-American Eastern Star Church led by Indianapolis pastor Jeffrey A. Johnson. Dobelmeyer may be best known for his public television specials on Reinhold Niebuhr, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Howard Thurman, Dorothy Day, and Abraham Joshua Heschel, part of the Prophetic Voices series. In addressing religious subjects, Dobelmeyer is both ecumenical and interfaith, bringing a respectful and deferential lens to his subjects. He includes a segment on Islam's Friday noontime Juma prayer, so central to the faith, and in some ways similar to a Sabbath. RNS spoke to Dobelmeyer about the making of Sabbath and how he tried to explore religious as well as secular benefits to the biblical day of rest. The interview was edited for length and clarity. Why did you want to do a two-part series on the Sabbath? Rereading the Sabbath in preparation for doing the film on Heschel sparked some thinking about the idea. It was an interesting universal topic. Doing films for public television, we're looking for religious topics that can reach a broad audience. The notion of organized, institutionalized, mandated rest was something I felt everyone in the culture needed. As we unpacked the story and did the research, we discovered groups and organizations calling for a one-day-a-week tech Sabbath from cell phones and laptops. So it not only applies to people who gravitate to a religious expression of their beliefs, but also to those who are a-religious but are looking for a way to step out of the culture and do it routinely. For all those factors, Sabbath was a good topic. We filmed it at the tail end of the pandemic. We were able to witness people filtering back into the pews. That was a good sign that maybe the Sabbath will bring them back into congregational life again. Several segments of the documentary feature religious communal farming, both at Princeton Theological Seminary's Farminary and at Abundance Farm a Jewish food project in Northampton, Massachusetts. What's the connection with Sabbath? The notion of Sabbath is rooted in the story of creation. On the seventh day, God rested. Discovering people in Princeton, New Jersey, who, as part of a theological tradition, wanted to teach farming to a new generation of pastors, was a wonderful connection. Whatever they draw from the land, they replenish back into the land. This is part of God's creation and the Sabbath story. In Massachusetts, at Abundance Farm, it's not just the notion that we have to rest, but we have to rest from our involvement and engagement in the world. The world needs to rest from us. That's the underlying theme. It's the story, it's part of the story of the Sabbath. Many of the people you interviewed seem to evolve in their thinking about Sabbath. Tell me about one. We were out in Los Angeles and spent a week at Our Lady Queen of Angels. La Placida is the name of the church. The priest does 8 masses and 60 baptisms over the course of the weekend. He came to me and said, "Thank you for making me think of Sabbath. I hadn't thought about it deeply, and this has forced me to go back and revisit my own tradition." Sure enough, he preached on Sabbath while we were there. In a small way, if we can get people to connect the dots and to think about creation and themselves and rest, hopefully, we can contribute in some way to what's happening in the culture. In one part of the documentary, you talked to college students at Berkeley who came from Sabbath-observing homes, but now they're on their own. Why did you include them? If you're raised in a particular tradition, once you get to that age, 18, 20, 22, you have to make your own choices. Does the Sabbath as a practice work for you? We didn't want to shy away from the fact that people are struggling over that. We wanted to look at the reality that in a 24/7 world, and especially a competitive world, these young people do it sometimes, but not all the time. I thought that was admirable. It's not easy to put down your cell phone or your books or to walk away from a job. The word trust came up over and over again. Can you trust that if you put down the work for a day, that your coworker will not jump ahead in line? That's not the way most of us think today. We think we have to be in the fight. Some people have described Sabbath as countercultural, a defiant or even rebellious act. Do you agree? Susanna Heschel, the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel, talked about being raised in the Heschel household. He was known as a great champion of civil rights, friend of Martin Luther King Jr. He was on the front lines in Selma, campaigned to end the war in Vietnam, championed Soviet Jews. But on Shabbat, Susanna Heschel says, her family didn't talk about those things. It was not appropriate. And I thought, there's a lesson here. It's the willingness to let your soul have a day off, to be able to commit to not thinking or talking about those things that can be divisive, disruptive, or argumentative. To let your soul have a day of rest is just as valuable as engaging in public communal worship. It's absolutely vital, especially in the culture today. Our last article is from the Religion News Service, published on May 15, an opinion piece by Rear Admiral Gregory N. Todd, Chief of Naval Chaplains. The Navy needs more chaplains. Not since the end of the Cold War has the Department of Navy wanted to increase the size of the chaplain corps, those religious ministry professionals dedicated to the well-being of sailors, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, and their families. And yet, that's where we are today. All three sea services want and need more chaplains. It's not that the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard have prescribed religion. The federal government and the U.S. military, while deferential, are agnostic to faith and religion. This is as it should be. One's faith and one's soul are too important to allow the government to have a say. It's personal and it's sacred. Our leadership, though, recognizes that when human beings attend to all aspects of their humanity, mind, body, and spirit, they are happier, more resilient, and more ready to face the challenges of military service. Sound like a concept cooked up by the chaplain corps or maybe a philosophy class? Not so. More than 30 years of peer-reviewed research from Columbia University, Duke, and Harvard in mental health, epidemiology, and spirituality demonstrate the value of the spiritual for human flourishing. For example, those engaged in spiritual practices, including religion, are 50 to 80% less likely to die by suicide, 60% less likely to suffer depression, 80% less likely to suffer addiction, and 70% less likely to participate in risky behaviors. Dr. Lisa Miller of Columbia University has spent a career researching how spiritual practices impact depression and other disorders, most notably the rise in suicide among young adults. She states that there is no protective factor identified by the clinical sciences that, in scope or scale, compares to the protective benefits of religious and spiritual engagement against suicide. Our leaders' desire for more chaplains in the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, and it's purely a matter of taking care of people. Chaplains have proven themselves as a resource to strengthen the force and are outstanding partners with mental health professionals to get the people the help needed should they find themselves in crisis. More chaplains simply means more care for our people. Throughout our history, America's religious organizations have encouraged the Navy to adequately provide for the religious needs of sea service personnel. But we cannot provide for their needs where there are no chaplains. In order to care for the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, the Navy needs chaplains. And despite the Department of the Navy asking for more, the recruiting deficit is extreme. I am appealing to America's religious organizations and their leaders to prioritize ministry to the Americans who have chosen to serve our nation. The bulk of our flock are 18 to 25-year-olds, often faced with adult challenges for the first time in their lives. We need more chaplains to care for these young people and their families. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.